Several years ago, I told a story that is too appropriate to the whole framework of what I want to say, not to tell again, and besides, as you will see, it's a story that in some ways has echoes in another story at the end of the sermon. I grew up in a home of a rabbi who, since he became a rabbi after the Second World War, was passionately concerned with building the State of Israel, freeing Soviet Jewry, building schools and synagogues and federations. And in our home, there was a great deal of talk about Israel and anti-Semitism and what Jews needed and how the Jewish community would live and survive, but very little talk about God. Theology was not the central concern, but sociology. And it was what the Jewish people needed to do. God was invoked in brises and bar mitzvahs, but I am hard-pressed to remember a discussion about the nature of God around the dinner table. Now, fast forward several years. I've become a rabbi, and I've just published my second book, and it, like the first, is all about God. Since, of course, if your father's a rabbi and you're a rabbi and you got to rebel somehow, you may as well choose some niche that he left untilled. So one day I'm sitting in my office at what is now the American Jewish University, and the phone rings. The other end of the line, man says, "My name is so-and-so, and I write for Newsweek magazine, and we're doing a cover story on God." "Would you be interested in being interviewed?" So, of course, I say yes, and I know that as I'm talking to him, I'm supposed to be thinking exalted thoughts, but I want to tell you what was running through my mind. Short sentences, be quotable. So I tell him what I just told you about my upbringing and my parents and so on, fine. Weeks pass, and each Monday morning I stop by the newsstand to see if my Newsweek is there, and all these trivial world events keep intervening. But then each year around Christmas or Easter, there is a religious magazine, and by the way, always sells the best of any news magazine during the year. And I drive there, and I see on the newsstands the cover says Talking to God, and I jump out of my car, and I grab it from the stand, and I open it up, and I find the article, and there's a picture of me, and underneath it says, "My father was a rabbi and a good one, but growing up in his house, he never once mentioned God." Now, at the time, my father was still, he's since retired, was still the rabbi of a large conservative synagogue in suburban Philadelphia. And as I read it, I could hear the voices of his congregants. And I knew which ones. So I was extremely upset. I ran to my office. I sprung into action. I called my father. And my father, who is a gentle and wonderful man, said, "Don't worry, it's not a problem, I understand, these things happen, fine." Then I called my mother. My mother, who I think it is fair to say is somewhat more driven by temperament than my father, said nothing in the whole conversation when I told her what happened until finally I said, "Listen, I've got to go, but I want you to know I just called him and really he's okay." To which she made the only comment she made in the whole conversation. She said, "Uh-huh." And I thought, maybe I haven't heard the end of this. So a couple days later, I go to my mailbox and there's a letter from my father. And my heart sinks. Because I know my father. And I know he's not going to say, "It's a terrible thing you did, and how could you do this?" But he's Jewish. And it's not inconceivable that he will go for a sort of guilt light. You know? and say, look, I just hope you learn from this. You have to be very careful when you speak to the press, something like that. So I open up the letter, and inside it reads as follows. It says, Dear David, God. 100 times down the page. And then at the bottom it says, P.S., this is just in case time calls you for an interview. So why do I bring this up? Because really, I believe that then and now, whether it was enunciated, whether it was made explicit or not, one thing is powerfully true about people in general, but about the Jewish people and the Jewish tradition. When I was a boy, I read a story by Jack London called To Build a Fire. And the story is about a man who has a single match, and he's in a vast snowfield, and he knows if he cannot light that match, he will die. What I believe is that the Jewish people has a single match. And it's not Israel, and it's not community, and it's not social action, as important as those are. It's the Ner Tamid. It's the eternal light. It is faith. Without that, everything on the Jewish tree will wither and die. Without the fire of faith, without the belief that what you see, the physical material world, is not all, that there is something greater, that we have an intuition of transcendence, of something greater than us, that we are not the best things going, that we can draw inspiration from that which is beyond us, without us, that the Jewish people are lost. Olam, the Hebrew word for world, shares a root with ne'elam, which is the Hebrew word for hidden. Because our tradition teaches God is hidden in the world. I can't show you God. I can't point to God. But the idea that God is hidden suggests that God can be sought, can be looked for. To be hidden is not to be absent. To be hidden is not to cease to exist. It's just to be hidden. Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav said, there were two kinds of hiding that God did in the world. Hester panim, the hiding of God's presence. The first is a normal hiding. The second is worse. The second is people from whom it is hidden that God is hiding. In other words, they don't look because they don't know that there's something hidden there. Because they are dazzled by the enormity and the splendor and the wonder of what is, of what exists, and so they don't look behind to see beyond what exists. Have you ever asked yourself, why is the Bible so upset, so exorcised about idolatry? What does it matter if you build an idol? Okay, it's foolish, it's stupid, it's wasteful, but really, why do the prophets scream about idolatry so? It is interesting to note, by the way, that nowhere do they say that the problem with idolatry is what we assume the problem with idolatry is. Heschel put it beautifully. He said, most people assume the problem with idolatry is it's an insult to God. God is this intangible being, and you build this statue of wood, and you say, that's God, and God gets insulted. Heschel said, the truth is, look, God can take the insult. God is God. The problem with idolatry is that there exists an image of God in this world. It's in every human face. Not literally. But in some spiritual sense, we represent God in this world. And so when you point to a statue and say that's God, it's not that you're insulting God. It's that you're insulting yourself. Don't worry, it's just a little image of God. And that you're not allowed to do. That insult you cannot take. This idea, the idea that human beings are images of God, tells us that our purpose is enacted faith. Faith brought into the world. That's why when I said before, it's not community, it's not Israel, it's not social action, all those things are enacted faith. They are what we are supposed to do with the faith we have. It's the way we're supposed to look at another human being and not see in them just an accident of ancient chemistry, but something holy. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was the founder of the Brisk method of studying Talmud, a great scholar and a great thinker, an intellectual, and therefore not somebody you would think necessarily always knew how to treat his fellow human beings. Spent most of his time with books. But let me tell you a lovely story about the Brisker Rav. One night, someone came to his town. And remember, in Eastern Europe, you know, there was no Motel 6. You came to a town, you either got put up at the synagogue or you found someone's house. And all the homes were dark. It was the middle of the night. Except, of course, the light was on where Rabbi Soloveitchik was studying. So the man very diffidently knocked at the door. And the rabbi answered the door, and he said, I have no place to stay. May I come in? And he invited him in and said, it's fine, come in. He made dinner for him. And the man kept saying, don't trouble yourself, because he saw from all the books in the house that this obviously was a learned man. He didn't know who he was, but he knew that he was somebody who spent most of his time studying and learning. The next morning, he gave the man fresh clothes to wear, and he made him breakfast, and the mantra continued. The guy said, don't trouble yourself. Please, don't trouble yourself. And the rabbi didn't answer him. Just carried on. But it was a Thursday morning. It's a morning on which we read the Torah in synagogue. And so the man came with him to the synagogue. And the rabbi spoke to the gabbai, the ritual director, and said, give him the honor of Hagbah, which is raising the Torah. So the time came, and the man grabbed the handles of the Torah and was about to lift it when Rabbi Soloveitchik tapped him on the shoulder and smiled at him and said, don't trouble yourself. And he understood. It's an honor, not a burden. That's the point. This is enacted faith. When a person comes to you in the middle of the night and you're kind to them, it's not a burden. It's a chance to lift the Torah. There was a Torah hidden in this man, shining but hidden. But you have to see the world that way, as though it is shot through with radiance. But sometimes our vision is dulled. Sometimes we don't look up. Sometimes we are blinded by what we can see, so that we don't see what is not visible. You know this from what has been happening the past couple of days. It's frightening. And again, I hear people using the same significant phrase. They say people could lose everything. First of all, in one sense, that's true. They can lose everything, but people don't live by everything. If you believe that the only thing that exists is what human beings make, what they create, their productivity, their creativity, their structures, then when those are lost, you've lost everything. But if you understand that something moves through us, that we are prisms that refract the light that exists in this world and give it off in many colors, then you know that no one loses everything when they lose money. No one loses everything when they lose possessions. That our people, again and again and again, have lost things, but not lost themselves. This is a special kind of vision. I'm tempted to say it's a special kind of artistry. The modern Swiss artist Paul Klee once said that art doesn't reproduce the visible. Art makes visible. Sure, you've seen an apple. But when Cézanne shows you an apple, you see something about an apple that's not visible just by looking at an apple. Art shows you something new that you wouldn't have seen, and so does faith. Faith re-enchants the world and shows us a world that we would not otherwise see, and shows us human beings as we would not otherwise see them, and it shows us ourselves as we are and as we could be. I began this evening by telling you a story about my father. And I want to end by telling you a story about my father, although in some ways it's not about him at all. It's a story that I included in the book because it's an illustration of exactly what it is that I'm talking about this evening. And it is, besides, a beautiful story. When my father was a child, his father died suddenly, and his mother was left alone as a young widow, and my father was 11 years old. They lived in Boston, and in Boston there was a pier that led out into the harbor that was called the Widow's Walk, because from there, in the war, ships had gone out. And women would wait each day for their husbands to come home. And my father and grandmother used to walk by that pier, but they knew that her husband was never coming home. As a young boy in a more or less traditional community, each morning he used to walk to the synagogue to say Kaddish for his father. And about the second or third week that he left his home to say Kaddish, he saw the shamus, the ritual director, whose name was Mr. Einstein, walking by his house. And he said to him, "You know, it's on the way, and I thought, why not pick you up and we'll walk together? That way I won't have to walk alone each morning to shul." And so, through the seasons, through the real New England seasons, through the golden fall, through the cold winter, through the humid Boston summer, the two of them walked together day after day. And my father was not alone. Years later, when my father grew up and was married, and they had my oldest brother, he went back to Boston and he called Mr. Einstein. And he said, "You know, I would love for you to meet my son." Mr. Einstein was now well into his 90s, and he didn't go out of his house much. So he said to my father, "I would love to meet your son. Why don't you and your wife bring him by the house? I'll give you directions. You'll come by, and we'll meet." And now I'd like to quote you what my father wrote. "The journey was long and complicated. His home by car was fully 20 minutes away. I drove in tears as I realized what he had done. He'd walked for an hour to my home so that I would not have to be alone each morning. By the simplest of gestures, the act of caring, he took a frightened child and led him with confidence and faith back into life." Why did he do that? Because Mr. Einstein had faith. He had faith that no mitzvah, no goodness, no story he's ever lost. That again and again they can be told and they can touch hearts. He had faith that the light that we introduced to the world could still give warmth. He believed, as I hope you do as well, that inactive faith, faith brought into the world, can change lives again and again and again. As we face the year to come, we know there will be joys, there will be tragedies, there will be risks, and there will be loss. But if we face them all with faith, then the light that first was kindled thousands of years ago, which remains to this day in our lives and in our hearts, that light will endure. And it will enable us to see the radiance of God's world, and through good times and bad, to stay not only warm, but embraced by those who love us and by God. Shana Tova.